You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, folks. Just a quick announcement. We're in the midst of a very important fundraising drive to come up with all of our production costs for 2016. So if you like Kick-Ass Politics and you value what I'm doing here, then I hope you'll go to gofundme.com/kickasspolitics and donate what you can. It's vital that we fund our production budget for the coming year so I can focus my energies on the content side of Kick-Ass Politics, which is probably a lot more involved than you might think. So be a part of what I'm creating here. Just go to gofundme.com/kickasspolitics or hit the donate button on our webpage at kickasspolitics.com. If you go there now and donate something, anything, doesn't matter what amount, I promise I'll keep doing what I'm doing here and producing new shows for you every week. Thanks in advance, folks. And now, enjoy the show. Welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. I'm your host, Ben Mathis. Folks, I want to pitch you an idea that I have for a sitcom. Kind of a buddy comedy with political overtones. Now, hear me out. The premise is two powerful Washington senators. One's a Democrat, one's a Republican. One's from the Deep South, the other's from the Midwest. And they go on a wacky adventure and find love on the open road. Okay, maybe not. But what does happen is they each get elected to Congress, do a few years in the House, and then they both get elected to the U.S. Senate, more or less around the same time. As senators, they work their way up the ranks, and eventually both make it to the top as the leaders of their respective parties in the Senate. And that touches off a friendly little ongoing competition to be the top dog in the U.S. Senate. Over the next 10 years, both men learn not to get too comfortable in the big office as they ping-pong back and forth between majority leader and minority leader. But when you're the two most powerful men in the Senate, you're insulated by chiefs of staff, press secretaries, aides, other senators, and it's hard to get anything done if you can't pick up the phone and talk to the guy on the other side of the aisle. So one day these two get the bright idea to install a red phone between the majority leader's office and the minority leader's office. These two senators figure they swap desks more than an office temp, so regardless of which one of them is minority leader or majority leader on any given day, it's still going to be just the two of them on either end of that direct line. And when they do that, something crazy happens. The more they communicate, the more these two guys from opposite ends of the political spectrum actually get things done. After they retire from the Senate, they write a book and hit the open road to preach civility, bipartisanship, and mutual respect in the midst of the most rancorous political climate in modern memory. Their book is called Crisis Point: Why We Must and How We Can Overcome Our Broken Politics in Washington and Across America. And those two senators are Trent Lott and Tom Daschle. They say partisan politics has driven both parties so far to their extremes that many politicians are actually terrified of trying to work together and find middle ground for fear that the fanatical wings of their own parties will drive them out of office and replace them with someone even farther to the right or left than they are. Just ask former Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, or Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, or ask Congressman Eric Cantor. Well, these two senators say that the Founding Fathers always intended for conflict and debate to be necessary parts of a healthy legislative process, but partisanship and outright nastiness have disrupted the process so badly that our lawmakers aren't really able to do much lawmaking at all, and they warn of an iron curtain descending on the U.S. Congress. We'll talk about that coming up in just a moment with my guests today, former Senate Majority Leaders Tom Daschle and Trent Lott. Coming up in just a moment.
Hollywood to Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
Well, folks, some podcasts may have one senator. Occasionally, they may even have two senators. But today, I have in studio with me two former Senate Majority Leaders. Not only that, but two-time former Senate Majority Leaders, Senator Tom Daschle and Senator Trent Lott. Guys, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Well, you have a new book called Crisis Point, Why We Must and Can Overcome Our Broken Politics in Washington and Across America. First off, who is your audience for this book? Is it the American people, or is it the politicians who are the ones who seem to be a part of this whole problem?
Actually, we think it's all of the above, Ben. We really believe that the American people have so much at stake right now. Our country really has to come to grips with the fact that we've got a dysfunctional government. And until the leaders of our country and the people of our country come together to realize how broken things are, we really don't believe we're going to be able to address it. So electoral reform, congressional reform, and a call to service are some of the things that we think are so critical if we're going to put this country back on track.
I'd agree, all of the above. It is aimed at the American people. We talk a lot about their need to participate. The voter participation rate is unbelievably low, 38% in 2014. So we talk a lot to the American people about their role, their civic responsibility, how we can help get higher turnout and greater participation. But it's also aimed at people that are running for office. But to me, it's aimed to a lot of people in Washington, like the president or the future president, and the members of Congress. They've got to find a way to communicate and work together to get positive results for the country.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you mentioned turnout just now. And in the book, you talk about that being one of the keys, how turnout has decreased year after year and gotten worse. And that's only feeded the divisiveness and the need to appeal to the base. And that's part of the problem, isn't it?
I had a constituent once who said, I never voted, just encourages them. And I think what she meant by that is that she's so turned off by it that she doesn't want to participate. And that's kind of intuitive, I guess. If you don't think things are going well, you don't want to be a part of it. But it's counterintuitive to suggest this, but we believe it's all the more reason to be involved, to vote, to participate, to send your voice, to make sure that the far right and the far left don't dominate the political landscape as they have been. We need to bring the American people back to part of the dialogue again. And that is not what we're seeing. When voter turnout is this low, only the extremes get their voice, and that isn't the way it should be.
You know, both parties now talk about appealing to their base, which is a term we didn't really hear until the 90s, and it has grown and grown. When I ran for Congress the first time as a Republican in South Mississippi, where a lot of people had never seen a live Republican, I didn't have a base. What I wanted was everybody, whether they were old or workers or professional. I was out there trying to get the few that thought that they were Republicans, but also a hell of a lot of Democrats and independents. The base was the people. And, I went after them regardless of what their economic status was or even what their philosophical base was. What I tried to say is, look, I'm young, energetic. I've had good experience. Give me a chance to do the job for you. And they did.
Well, one of the other problems we face, and Trent and I have talked a lot about this in the book, it used to be that the voters picked their politicians and they picked their leaders. Now the politicians are picking the voters by the way they design the districts, where it becomes 85% predictable, Republican or Democratic. Yeah. And that's really, again, alienated a lot of the voters. So what we've got to do is to go back and make sure that these districts are competitive once again, so that it isn't just the base that has the voice, that it is the middle and the all of those who really want to be a part of the process but don't feel they're welcome anymore.
But hasn't the gerrymandering always been a problem way, way back? I thought we were getting better at this.
There are some areas where we're getting better. Some of the states like Florida and Washington State in particular have done a good job. How do you set up a truly nonpartisan or an independent commission? It's almost impossible. I guarantee you that, you know, if I were involved in Mississippi, I'd try to make sure that commission leaned my way. But in Washington, what they did in designing the districts, they picked one highly respected Republican, one highly respected Democrat, only two, that had hearings all over the state. Then they drew the lines, but they had to both agree to those lines. And the result was that people all over the place felt like, hey, they did a good job. Now, you also, particularly in the South, you have the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So some of those districts are drawn the way they are so that there will be minority representation. Whether you agree with that or not, it is a fact that we have to come to terms with.
Well, in the book, you talk about the solution to finding the middle again and being able to make things work. It comes down to four things: conflict, chemistry, leadership, and vision. Now, first, let's talk about conflict, because on the face of it, most people would probably think that that's what this book is against. But you say conflict isn't a bad thing, and it's actually even essential. We've just lost sight of the purpose behind the conflict. What is that?
Well, the conflict is really a word to describe what we think is one of the strengths in America. Trent feels strongly as a conservative Republican about things, and I feel strongly as a liberal and progressive Democrat. That doesn't mean we give up our identities as we search for common ground and in the middle. That conflict of ideas, that you could use the word competition for good ideas and good public policy, is really what it's all about. For 220 years, we've had extraordinarily effective competition for ideas. Sometimes it's about the role of government. Sometimes it's about the vision for America. Sometimes it's about new ideas we'd never thought of before. But it's that conflict, that competition between conservatives and liberals, Democrats and Republicans, that really bring out the best in both of us.
Both of you served both in the House and the Senate, correct?
Right.
And the Founding Fathers originally described the House as the teacup with the boiling hot water, and the Senate was supposed to be the saucer where the water cooled down a little bit, the more rational, deliberative body. In this day and age, it seems that the Senate has been infected with the same angry mob, torch-wielding mob mentality of the House. I wonder, has the Senate basically become like the House?
Well, I think they still are a little bit of what was originally intended. The House is still pretty hot, maybe too hot. And the Senate is, the cooling place, and it's become cold because they haven't found a way to even get a result. Quite often, they don't even get to vote on the substance of a bill. But, you can work through that. When I was in the House for 8 years, I was the Republican whip during the Reagan years. And we won for 6 years almost every vote over and over again. And we did it by holding most of the Republicans, but not all of them, and getting a pretty good number of Democrats, including 40 or 50. But also we had a president who would work with the Congress, Democrats and Republicans. He talked to us. He met with us. And to his credit, we had a liberal speaker of the House of Representatives named Tip O'Neill. They were friends, a couple of Irishmen. They would have a little drink and laugh at each other. But Tip O'Neill made sure that President Reagan's issues were voted on. He didn't even have to do that. That was a special time in many respects. And it's a perfect example of how it can and should be done again.
But one of the big differences, Ben, between then and now is how much time was spent in Washington. Back then, Trent and I both moved our families to Washington. One of the reasons we had the chemistry we did is that we got to know each other socially. We got to do things together. And that built an environment that created the relationship that allowed the communication to move the legislation. That no longer happens. People leave on Thursday, they come back on Tuesday, and they try to run the country on Wednesday. They don't know each other like they used to. The money chase is a big reason for that. There are so many factors, but we've bashed Washington for so long. Now it's almost just unheard of to move your family to Washington. So if you can't spend any time there, you don't have the ability to do the kind of legislating and the kinds of things that are so critical to good governance, just as importantly today as it was back 30 and 40 years ago.
And, you know, the job is in Washington, after all.
Yeah.
I went home every other weekend for 17 years. I stayed in touch with my constituency. They knew who I was. I knew them. And they were comfortable with that. And they gave me a lot of leeway because I kept communicating with them. Sometimes I led in a way they didn't always agree or vote the way I always agreed, but I tried to explain it. Communication is such an important part of governing, but also of making sure your constituents know what you're up to and what you're doing. I found they're very forgiving. If you explain that what is the rationale? Remember, this is a Republican form of government. This is not where we govern by referendum. This is where good men and women are sent to Washington, in this case, the Congress, to study the issues and learn what's best for the country and vote accordingly.
Yeah, and one of the things that I loved in here was Senator Daschle, you said that you think one of the biggest enemies to bipartisanship is the airplane.
Well, that's really shorthand for what we were just describing. I mean, the airplane has made it so much easier for people to leave. In the old days, you know, you stayed. I had 4 paid trips when I first was elected to the Senate or the House in 1978. 4 paid trips home, and so you didn't have the luxury. Now there's no limit. You can get paid for as many trips home as you want to make, and people are gone because their families are in their states. They've got to go out and raise all this money. So there are all these reasons not to be in Washington. Over 50 members of Congress sleep on their sofas. That gives new meaning to public housing, but it's not really something we think is a good idea. But we've got to really go back to figure it out. One of the ideas that we feel strongly about is Congress ought to have votes 5 days a week,
absolutely,
3 weeks a year, or 3 weeks a month. Okay. And if you had Monday votes, Friday votes, and you had votes all that block of time, people would look differently at how much time they've got to spend in Washington, get to know each other, and you'd finally start moving legislation.
You know, legislating takes time, and the Congress is not just about passing bills or stopping bills. It's also about taking a look at what they did. They don't have time now when they come in and out of town so fast to really do investigations and hearings and oversight of agencies and departments. And I think that's one of the reasons why government continues to grow and expand, you know, endlessly. They don't take the time or have the time to do what needs to be done.
Yeah, and I think back to, a number of senators, but in particular, Liddy Dole, Senator Elizabeth Dole. She got ran out of North Carolina because they said that she didn't spend enough time in the state.
Well, and you have to do that.
You do. But you know, it seems that, you know, we obsess with building relationships with our constituents or with your constituents, but not building relationships with other senators and other congressmen,
and that
makes it very hard.
Very, very important. You know, when I was in the House, I lived on a street in Northern Virginia where our kids went to school, and on that same street was a Republican from Ohio and 3 Democrats from Louisiana. Our kids played together. Our wives are friends. We enjoyed each other's company socially. And when I was counting votes for Ronald Reagan in the House of Representatives and for the American people, if I needed to get information about Democrats, I could go across the street and ask John Brose, hey, what's the deal? And he would speak to me honestly. I don't think that happens now.
And it doesn't have to be. I think it's almost a false choice to say constituents or Washington. I think you can do both if you manage the time more effectively, if you show the leadership necessary to schedule that allows careful consideration of these extraordinary challenges we face today and ways to solve them.
In this digital technological age with the internet, it ought to be easier to do that.
No question.
Well, all of this speaks to the second point that you make in the book, which is what you guys call chemistry. Now, we're not talking about, you know, the eHarmony, you know, Match.com chemistry, but there is kind of almost a similar element to this. So explain the kind of chemistry that you're talking about among legislators.
Well, first of all, it's respect for people of different points of view. In the case of Tom and me, we not only communicated a lot. We even had a red phone on our desk. When I picked it up, it rang only one place, on Tom's desk. So we could talk around our staff sometime, and without going through the media, we could talk directly about what we were trying to do on an important issue for the country. So that was an important part of it. But also,
was it red?
It was red. Yep.
Okay.
Mine was. I think
you couldn't lose. Yes. You couldn't. Neither of you could launch a nuclear strike from it, though.
That's
right.
That's right. Okay. But that was all. It was a harmless phone, except for the fact that we could talk with each other.
We did talk quickly the day of 9/11 when we were both in our offices realized we were under attack. He was the majority leader then, and I picked up the phone and he answered. I said, "Tom, I think we're fixing to be hit next. We better get out of here. Order the evacuation of the Capitol," which he did. And so, but it also it's a matter of trust. We agreed from the very beginning we weren't going to surprise each other. We tried to see, what needed to be done to get a result. After 9/11, how did we do all the things we needed to do for the, airline industry that had been severely damaged? And the city of New York City, when they hit New York, they hit America. And we passed a lot of positive legislation in the aftermath of that. And so we had to, communicate. And sometime our respective conferences didn't necessarily want to move. And Tom and I would have to go to the floor and say, ladies and gentlemen, this is about our country. We're calling this bill up, and we're going to vote today. And you know what? When we took that position, people followed. Leadership needs followership. But most people will follow a true leader if you get out there and explain what you're trying to do. I feel like we kind of lost that now.
But it's almost impossible to overemphasize how critical chemistry really is. If you don't have that chemistry, if you can't talk to one another, if you can't trust one another, you aren't going to be able to communicate in a way that allows you to bridge the differences that exist philosophically in dealing with this so-called competition of ideas that we're facing today and that we've always faced historically. Chemistry is essential. And what we do in the book is try to find as many ways as possible to suggest ways that we can rebuild the chemistry that Trent and I had the luxury to experience the entire time we were both in office.
You know, there was a great quote from John C. Calhoun about Henry Clay. He basically says, I hate Henry Clay. I can't stand him. I wouldn't even speak to him. But by God, I love him.
It's a great quote.
Now, is the red phone still there? Do you know?
Unfortunately not. They don't exist anymore, and they wouldn't have to be red, but we just think that notion is a good idea. There are a lot of other ways you can do it, but the fact is that we don't have the same environment today. Leadership doesn't talk to each other like they used to. We don't have the communication with the president that Trent and I both talked about with our relationship with President Clinton in particular. Those kinds of things don't exist today, and that's part of the problem.
Yeah, and there's a lot to be said for being able to cut through all of the aides and all of the different layers between two leaders. Well,
let me give you a glimmer of hope, though.
Yeah?
Of how it can work.
I could use one.
And how it has worked recently. A few years ago, Paul Ryan, who was then chairman of the, of the Ways and Means Committee or Budget Committee, worked with Patty Murray, a Democrat, in the Senate designated by the Democratic leader to come up with a budget agreement. John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi came up with an agreement on the so-called dock fix. It had been hanging over the Congress for 10 years, and they came together and made it happen. They did a highway bill this year. How did it happen? It happened because Bill Shuster, who's one of the best legislators in the House of Representatives and in the Congress, worked with, guess who? Barbara Boxer of California, and they produced a highway bill that will help with infrastructure in America. It can happen, and it happens a little bit. We need more of that.
Yeah, the problem is, though, that you have the Tea Party that basically tried to drive the Speaker out of the House after that.
Well, they did.
Yeah, and they did. You're right. They succeeded. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll talk about some of the possible ways to fix America's partisan divide with my guests today, Senator Trent Lott and Senator Tom Daschle. Back in just a moment. Folks, do you like to read, but you don't have the time? Give audiobooks a try. All those times you spend listening to this podcast, you can also be listening to a great book. You can play it on your drive to work, on a run, in the bathtub, while cooking, or just sitting and enjoying one of those rare stolen moments. And right now, you can download any audiobook you want for free with a special promotion for our listeners from Audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free download of any of Audible's 180,000 titles for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, iPad, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. We're back, and I'm talking with Senators Trent Lott and Tom Daschle about their new book, Crisis Point. One thing that comes up in here that's interesting is that Senator Daschle's successor, Bill Frist, campaigned in South Dakota against him in 2004, which you guys say that nobody used to campaign against their colleagues in the Senate. And that's a relatively new phenomenon. And it seems that when you do that, that's kind of hard to come back from. Well, it's hard to shake hands and break bread after you've done that.
With leadership positions.
Yeah.
Because the leaders of all people have got to be able to communicate and talk and respect each other. And if you go in, I mean, it was an unwritten rule. I don't know of any example where that happened before. And when I was asked about it at the time, would I have gone in a campaign against Tom Daschle? I said, absolutely not.
And I'm saying this as a Republican. It seems to me that when we're talking about this particular problem, that the larger part of the problem right now is coming from our side. Am I right, Senator Lott?
Well, again, I think there's plenty of blame to go around. But our candidates that are running for president have been pretty shrill in how they've handled themselves. And I'm talking about Cruz and Trump too. It doesn't, in my opinion, it shouldn't be the way it is now. It has gotten clearly more coarse.
But the debate is not just philosophical. It's not just a right-left or a conservative-liberal. It's also tactical. It's do you find common ground or do you stand your ground? And there are many who believe that compromise is capitulation. You can't run a country this complicated in a democracy and not find common ground. It is not capitulation. To stand your ground and never compromise is just another way to describe dictatorship. We don't support dictatorships in this country. We support those who find compromise and common ground to take into account the country's diversity philosophically and demographically and in every other way. We've got to find that. Our founding fathers set the example for finding common ground. We've got to continue to do that in 2016.
Well, let me speak up and answer to your previous question in defense of the Tea Party.
Sure. Yeah,
I knew a lot of the people that were involved in that early on. The people that I knew were concerned about the size of government, the deficit, the spending, and that was sort of the driving force. I think that element now has been co-opted by the later iterations that we're having to deal with. But, a lot of what Congress and American people need is not partisan or political. For instance, the Senate is going to be taking up a bill here in the next few days on energy policy. Now, energy is part of the strength of America. Now, the impact of having on lower, gas prices is, I don't know, we can't quite tell how that's going to turn out. But this bill will provide for more energy efficiencies, will provide for more grid where you can get all kind of fuels connected into the grid. It'll allow for export of liquefied natural gas. Now, you'll have tough amendments. You'll probably have amendments on what's going on with coal. You'll have other amendments that will be pretty controversial. But in the end, having a strong energy policy is good for America. They need to find a way to get that done.
Yeah, absolutely. And, but isn't part of the problem that people in y'all's position are just terrified of getting primaried at this point?
Absolutely.
I mean, if you veer from the standard party line in any way, you're under threat that you'll be driven out of town on a rail.
Well, we've given Dick Lugar the title he's characterized as a verb these days. People don't want to get Lugared. Dick Lugar lost his primary, maybe for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that he was such a compromise advocate and found common ground with his colleagues on a lot of issues. He was a strong conservative, and yet he found common ground, just like Ted Kennedy did on the left. But he was penalized for that, just as Bob Bennett and Michael Castle and so many others, Blanche Lincoln. I mean, it happens on both sides. And that's exactly why we've got to look at the primaries, because it's the primaries that are really driving a lot of this fear and intimidation. People are afraid of getting primaried today, of getting Lugared, and that's got to change.
It's true in both parties, but I think it's particularly true in the Republican Party. Now, you see a Republican that loses his or her seat, it's probably because they lost in a primary. And I realize, people are worried about it, but remember, if you're in the House of Representatives, you only serve 2 years. So you're really up every other year. You're really up all the time. You're running all the time. But remember also, we were designed to be citizen legislators. It's not supposed to be something you inherit and that you take with you when you die. Now, maybe you say, well, it's easy for y'all to say, for one reason or another, you're not there now. But I do think that you've got to live with your conscience. And if you're always going to be pushed around by the fear of the threat of a primary, how good a legislator and a representative are you going to be? There are other jobs out there. We'd like for people to come in, work hard, do a good job, and be prepared to go do something else if they get defeated for trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, and it seems that the voters now, they prize ideological purity so much higher than actually being able to get anything done. I want to move on to the third point in the book, which is that you say leadership is another one of the key elements to being able to make things work again. Now, you were both leaders of your respective parties in the Senate, and you guys came up in a different era when you still had those old lions of the Senate, the Ted Kennedys, the Robert Byrds, the John Warners, Strom Thurmond.
John Stennis of Mississippi was one of those.
Yeah, and talk about when you guys were junior senators just coming in, who were the senators who you admired or perhaps even mentored and influenced you when you were starting out?
Well, we had many. For me, it was one was Claude Pepper from Florida, a senator who was defeated and then became a congressman. And I'll never forget a conversation I had with him once where I asked him for his advice. And he said, you know, you're a Democrat and I'm a Democrat, but more important than whether you're an R or a D is whether you're a C or a D. Whether you're going to be a constructive or a destructive in the political and legislative process. He said, I hope you'll be a capital C, a constructive. But, you know, there are those that really believed in and understood the importance of the institutions of good government, who understood why our founding fathers created these institutions, and who really served to protect those institutions and had a loyalty for them that I think somewhat is lost today. I don't know that people have that same appreciation for the importance of institutions as hallowed as the Senate and the House, a recognition of the importance of respect for the institution, respect for the principles of our Constitution, our democracy, and who had the courage to lead, to step up to the plate and say, look, this may not be totally popular, you may not agree with this, but let me help you understand why it's so critical that we keep talking. More dialogue, more leadership, more commitment to the institutions is what we need now.
You know, the guy that really influenced me the most was not a senator. It was my predecessor in the House of Representatives. He was in Congress for 40 years, chairman of the Rules Committee and a Democrat. But he was a solid conservative, and he taught me a lot about civility and how calm persuasion can be very effective. Now, I succeeded John Stennis, again, a Democrat, in the Senate. He was known as the conscience of the Senate because of his ethics and his stature within his colleagues. He also had a saying that really stuck with me when I first came over to the Senate. He said, well, you know, young man, when some folks come over here, they grow. Others just swell. What he was saying there is grow, learn the institution, get the job done. Don't just get your head swelled and thinking you're some sort of a great statesman. But also, I learned a lot from watching people like Howard Baker and Bob Dole. And let me tell you, Ted Kennedy, you know, we fought like tigers. I disagreed with him on a lot of issues. On a few issues, we worked together. But you had to respect him because he was one of those lions of the Senate. Here's the question. Who are the lions of the Senate now? And you need that. You need the young blood like Tom and I represented. But you need the statesmen, the older men and women that have been there and can really guide you in how you do your job and also in your principles.
And there's a quality of a good leader that both Trent and I think, subscribe to. And it's an expression that I've used many times, and that is the best way to persuade is with your ears. That is, you've got to be a good listener in addition to a good talker. And what we need are more listeners today, and I'd like to see that happen on both sides of the aisle.
In the book, you talk about third parties, and these days that seems to be coming up more and more. There's talk of a Michael Bloomberg third party run, talk of former Senator Jim Webb going for a third party run. You guys say that's not the answer to finding the middle ground.
It doesn't have to be. Obviously, we've had a lot of third-party movements over the years and history, but I think the real answer is to take the two-party system, this competition of ideas, this importance we put on chemistry, this critical need for strong leadership, and make this two-party system work again. It's possible. We've done it before. We can do it again.
I agree with that.
Well, before we go, you talk about traditions being important to, you know, developing respect for the institution. Before we go, do either of you have any of those traditions that you miss?
Oh, absolutely. There are many. One is that you carve your name in the desk that you sat in on the Senate floor. And carving your name brings about this notion that you're part of history. And being part of history, I think, brings about this kind of respect for the institution itself.
You know, when I came to the House of Representatives, where I had been the whip for 8 years and always in the minority for 16 years, I came over to the Senate. I was kind of a partisan, hard-nosed warrior. And that was my attitude. I started to rock in the boat. Within 6 months, I figured out I was making people mad and I wasn't getting anything done. I was concerned I wasn't going to be able to do anything for my state and for my country. I took 6 months to learn the rules of the Senate, to talk to senators of both parties and all philosophies and say, tell me how to do this job. After 6 months, I put those principles to work. And 6.5 years later, I was a majority leader.
Well, good stuff. The book is called Crisis Point, Why We Must and Can Overcome Our Broken Politics in Washington and Across America. Now, everyone listening should read it, and I'll include Amazon links in the to order it on the show notes and on the website. And I have a suggestion that I think your publisher is going to really love. I want listeners to buy 3 copies, one for themselves and 2 to send to your congressman and to your senator, because those are the people who really need to be reading this. How about that, guys?
I really like it.
Thank you,
well,
Ben.
Senator Trent Lott and Senator Tom Daschle, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having
us. My pleasure, Ben.
Absolutely. Thanks again to Senators Trent Lott and Tom Daschle for taking the time during their book tour to swing by and come on the show. If you enjoyed this episode, then check out their new book, Crisis Point, Why We Must and How We Can Overcome Our Broken Politics in Washington and Across America. I'll include an Amazon link in the show notes for this episode and also on the website at kickasspolitics.com, where you can order their book. You can also support their work at the Bipartisan Policy Center, co-founded by Senator Daschle, and where Trent Lott currently serves as a senior fellow. Go to bipartisanpolicy.org. Don't forget to subscribe to Kickass Politics on iTunes, and while you're there, leave us a review. I'd also appreciate it if you went on our site and filled out a brief audience survey. And please, if you're so inclined, recommend Kickass Politics to your friends on social media. But if you really want to help us out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Whatever you can give is going to help us out, so go to gofundme.com/kickasspolitics and make a donation. Follow us on Twitter at KAPolitics or visit Kickass Politics on Facebook. And as always, I welcome your comments and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. In the next episode, the Iowa caucuses are coming up this Monday, February 1st. But what the heck is a caucus? And how much influence do the citizens of Iowa really have? We'll find out when I talk to some of the top political leaders and the biggest players in the Iowa caucuses. They'll reveal how it all works and how it's about much more than just picking a winner. And we'll also talk about that one particular issue that's gotten Senator Ted Cruz in a lot of hot water with Iowa voters. I'll give you a hint. It starts with an E. So be sure to tune in to the next podcast. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. This podcast may not be reproduced without express written permission. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.